activities and human interaction. It's not in a can.
Bonjour et welcome to Chat from the Mat, conversation inspirée de yoga with le grand Brian McRae Davis.
Alia Khan and I conducted this interview at Wanderlust in Snowshoe, West Virginia. She's a yoga teacher, and she owns a yoga studio in Washington, D.C. Now, she found herself in the business of yoga after becoming dissatisfied with her job as an attorney. The motivation came from understanding the difference between being comfortable and being happy. Alia talks about the removal of the religion from yoga without taking away the spirituality, and why, as a Muslim Indian American, that is so important to her. She offers some ideas why yoga is different than a regular workout and explains why she instructs in a very detailed and exacting manner. While the opportunity to open a yoga studio presented itself without seeking it, Alia talks about the planning and challenges of that process, the importance of being paid for what you are worth. She addresses the work ethic required of the owner of a yoga studio, her rituals, and also the importance of taking time away. And Alia gets a little vulnerable and opens up about her pre-bedtime ritual.
I am here with Alia Khan. Alia, correct?
Alia, yep, it rhymes with Aria.
Okay, Alia, tell the people listening where we are.
We are at the Wanderlust Festival in Snowshoe, West Virginia. And it is quite beautiful up here. The air is a little bit thinner. I have been learning that the hard way. Definitely getting a little bit more breathless than usual trying to teach and demo at the same time. But, you know, the challenge is all part of the fun.
And had you ever been to West Virginia before?
I've been to other parts of West Virginia. I've never been quite this deep into this part of the country. I live in Washington, D.C. There's a really lovely place called Harper's Ferry that's a pretty easy drive from D.C. And an easy place to play in the water and do fun things like whitewater rafting and tubing. So I've been there a few times, but this is, I think, my first real jaunt into West Virginia.
Would you say you are fond of nature?
Yes, absolutely. Certain aspects of nature. I am not a camper by any means. My version of camping involves a cabin and a shower and a hot tub and a fireplace and all that kind of stuff. But I love water. I love being in water, on water, near water, oceans, lakes, rivers, you name it. I am always happiest if there's water nearby and the sun is shining.
Okay. And Alia, what are you doing here in Snowshoe and at Wanderlust?
I was invited to teach here, actually. So I'm teaching 5 different classes, 3 of which have 90s themed playlists, which is one of my favorite ways to teach. Music is a big part of my teaching practice, and creating fun playlists to help my students really kind of get lost in the flow and the experience is super fun for me too. So today I taught my 90s hip hop class, and that was definitely a lot of fun. And tomorrow morning, we're starting at 8 a.m. with the 90s alt-rock class. That's going to be an interesting way for people to start the day. But the class is full. People are into it. So I am excited.
You can't argue with that.
Exactly.
You are a yoga teacher. You said you are based in Washington, D.C., or did I ask you that?
I said that I live in Washington, okay. D.C. Yes, I am based in Washington, D.C. currently. I own East Side Yoga in Washington, D.C., opened up the studio a little bit more than 2 years ago, but I grew up in Austin, Texas.
How did you get from Texas to Washington?
By way of law school. So I went to college in Austin, studied business for undergrad, and then moved to Philadelphia for law school, studied at Penn there, and then moved to D.C. to work for a big fancy law firm. Did that for nearly 5 years. Did a bunch of other stuff, and then ended up opening my yoga studio, like I said, a little bit over 2 years ago.
Now, of course, it's fairly common for lawyers to become yoga teachers.
Oh, absolutely. There's tons of us running around. No, it is fairly unique. Although, honestly, nowadays it seems like everyone and their dog is doing their yoga teacher training, which is cool. It's great to see that so many people are really getting into yoga and wanting to dive deeper than what simply practicing can offer them. And in DC, since pretty much everyone's a lawyer, most of the people doing their teacher training, or a lot of the people doing teacher training, are also attorneys now. But I don't know any other studio owners who are recovering attorneys like I am.
So you use the phrase recovering attorney, so you don't have fond memories of your legal career.
Well, it's a tongue-in-cheek, especially in a place like DC where so many people are currently attorneys. They get a kick out of that. It was a phrase I coined actually back when I was in real estate as a sort of non-douchey way to let people know that I had a JD and set myself apart from the other realtors. But even now, as I moved into yoga teaching and dedicated my career and really life to yoga, I find that it helps my particular client base relate to me to know that I have that chapter of life under my belt, because my mission as a yoga teacher is to bring the practice to kind of the more type A corporate person, in particular the people out there who think that yoga isn't for them, either because they tried it once and they didn't like it, or they haven't even bothered to try it because of the sort of hippy-dippy reputation that the practice has. So in all of my marketing and my branding and my teaching, I really put it out there that I'm sort of the anti-hippy-dippy yoga teacher. And one of the ways that I get that message across is by labeling myself as a recovering attorney. So I certainly was not fulfilled or happy as an attorney, but there were, of course, great things about it. There are certainly perks to working for a corporate law firm. I got to live in Paris for a while. Nice. But I think really the most valuable thing I got out of that experience was that I learned, you know, I lived the life that my students, my clients live now. So if I hadn't experienced that life myself, I wouldn't be able to teach to those people. I wouldn't be able to understand their needs and their pain and the things that they're dealing with, the stress that they're dealing with, the issues that they're dealing with. And therefore, because I understand them, because I lived that life, I'm able to craft classes and a teaching style that really resonates with them and works with their lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. Your experience as an attorney has created some common ground between you and your students.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that my experience as an attorney really helped me develop my niche as a yoga teacher. And then eventually when I opened my studio, it certainly helped me develop the culture around the studio as well and helped set us apart from the other studios in DC.
Do you find, apart from a commonality, that people treat you differently because of that experience?
Oh, that's an interesting question. In the yoga world, no. It's not so much that they treat me differently. I just think that I attract maybe a different pool of students than a lot of other yoga teachers do or would. Particularly folks that have maybe, like I said, either been nervous about trying it or have tried it before and didn't love it, but have heard that, you know, we do things differently at our studio or that I teach differently. So they're willing to give it a shot.
Now, you mentioned that you do things differently at your studio. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the simplest way to put it is that we skip the hippy-dippy stuff. but what that really means in practice is a couple of things. One is that it's really important to me that we leave out the religious element when teaching. And the reason why is that we want everybody to feel comfortable with this practice and comfortable that it fits in with whatever their own spiritual practice may be, whatever their own religious beliefs, if they have any, may be. Now, it's important to note, taking out the religious piece of it is not the same thing as taking out the spiritual aspect of it. I believe very strongly that what makes yoga such an incredibly powerful practice is that mind-body connection, that it's not simply a workout. It's not just about the physical aspect, but there is a very strong mental and even emotional aspect to this practice that comes from really tapping in to that deep connection between what your body is physically doing, what's happening in your mind, what's happening in your heart, right? And so, but there are ways to teach that that don't have to include religious mythology or iconography, and don't have to include some of the more kind of out there practices like chanting or sound healing or talking about chakras or energy fields or any of that kind of stuff. You know, you can really stick to sort of more practical everyday language, practical everyday anecdotes to help illustrate the points, to help illustrate the concepts and the lessons. For me personally, as a student, I found that my most powerful experiences were when I took a yoga class and then the next day I was back at work and something that my teacher said the night before popped into my head because it was so relevant to the thing that was happening right in front of me in my everyday life. So that when that started happening to me as a student, that was when I really started understanding the power of this practice and how it was much more than just a really nice way to make my back feel better, right? And so then when I started teaching, I really made it a point to teach in a way that would recreate that for my students. So talking about patience when you're waiting for the metro on the metro platform, which if you know anything about the metro in DC, you need a whole lot of patience when you're trying to ride that train. You know, talking about compassion in the context of getting cut off in traffic when you're on the road and trying to put yourself in the other person's shoes, that type of thing. So really using sort of everyday examples to help illustrate these really powerful and universal concepts that underlie the yoga teachings. Because that's the thing, is that, you know, the point of most religious mythology, the point of these stories is just to help illustrate these concepts. But the actual concepts, the meat of these teachings, the really powerful stuff, it's universal. It can be told and taught a lot of different ways. There's more than one way to do this. And I think that's the beauty of yoga in general. There's so many different flavors. I like to joke that there's more flavors of yoga than there are of ice cream out there. And so it's really important for everybody to try different teachers and different styles, practices, studios, until they find the right fit for them. And when I came into the world of yoga teaching and then actually opening up a studio, I wanted to make sure that I was offering something unique, not only based on my past experience, but also to try and bring the practice to a new pool of people.
Okay. Now, I'm sure that there are some people that are hearing this that are a little indignant right now, saying, well, I like chanting. What's wrong with chanting?
Absolutely. There's nothing wrong with chanting. If that's your jam, go for it. Okay. There are already lots of studios that offer that, those teachings and that experience, and I think that's fantastic, and I totally respect all of the other forms of yoga, all of the other ways of practicing it. My goal is simply to offer a new version of it, one that may resonate with a group of people that these other, maybe more traditional ways of practicing yoga don't resonate with.
Okay. And understanding that your background, your history is law and now a yoga teacher. And so I don't expect you to have a scientific response to this next question, but I'm sort of curious if in your experience you might have some insight. You mentioned earlier that yoga is more than just a physical practice. It can have an emotional impact. It can calm. It can create. It can have a deeper impact than just the physical. And that we don't need the quote unquote religion or the mythology to help us there. Do you have any idea why that might be? What's going on?
I don't totally understand the question.
So if we were going to go to an aerobics class, so we were going to go ride our bicycles for 20 miles or whatever it might be, we know that we're going to come out of this feeling a little fatigued, but we're going to feel, you know, physically challenged and feel a little bit better. And there is an emotional reaction to that that is usually beneficial.
Sure. What's different about yoga?
Yes. Yeah. I'd be curious to know if you have any insight.
Absolutely. So, you know, most forms of exercise release endorphins, right? There's a lot of science behind that. And that's why the runner's high is absolutely a thing.
That's why usually you feel pretty good after you exercise. Now, I guess that depends on the type of workout you did and what kind of shape you're in and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, I think no matter what, there's certainly a mental benefit to any kind of physical movement or exercise. But yoga takes it further. And I think part of the reason why is that it includes working with the breath. Our breath is such an incredibly powerful tool, one that we take for granted, one that so many of us like don't even consider as a tool that we can use. We just let it run in the background. But if you know how to work with your breath, you can use it to calm yourself down. You can literally use your breath to slow your heart rate, to relax your muscles. You know, there's a reason why you're supposed to take a deep breath when you get angry before you say the thing that you're about to say. So that's one element, is that I think that using the breath really taps into a part of the, one of the many systems that make up our bodies. Our bodies are such complicated, I guess, machines, for lack of a better word. And the mind and the emotions and the soul and all of those sort of intangible parts of who we are linked to our physical bodies, are linked to the tangible parts that we can touch and feel and move and control. And we're just, you know, at the tip of the iceberg of understanding how connection works from a scientific perspective. But all of the science out there definitely backs up the experience that people have been having for decades, maybe even centuries, when it comes to meditation and yoga, which is that you feel calmer, you feel more peaceful, you feel better in pretty much every sense of the word when you engage in these practices regularly. Now, one of the things that I think really sets yoga apart from something like running or biking or any of these more repetitive forms of exercise is that you have to pay a lot more attention to what is happening with your body in yoga. Especially with a practice, I teach vinyasa yoga, which means every class that I teach is different. The sequence is different. So the students have to listen to what I'm saying to know where we're going next. It's not just repeating the same sequence over and over again, right? So that forces them to really stay present and stay focused on the current moment. Whereas if you're doing something repetitive, like running or biking or whatever it is, you can put your body in autopilot. And your mind can keep wandering. And what I like to call that hamster wheel of your mind, that inner dialogue that so many of us have constantly running, it doesn't stop because you don't really need to focus on what your body's doing. You can just, you know, keep doing the same thing over and over again and keep going down that rabbit hole of your mind. Whereas with yoga, if you stop paying attention, you're going to fall over. Right? Like, that's the joke I like to make with my clients, is you're too busy trying not to fall over to be able to think about all that other stuff that's been weighing you down all day. And by the end of that hour, you've given that hamster wheel a break. You've let that part of your mind actually pause and reset because you've been focusing on your body. You've turned inward. You've stopped that constant dialogue. And instead, you've focused on your breath. You've focused on the movements. You've learned something new, probably about what's happening in your body that day. And so I really think that's a big part of what creates this powerful effect that goes beyond just a workout when you're practicing yoga.
I took your class this morning, which was lovely, by the way.
Well, thank you.
You have, apart from not chanting or bringing up some of the mythology that can be very popular, you have a very pragmatic approach to how you talk during class. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's that type A personality in me coming out. So I teach yoga the way I like to be taught, and I like to understand the reasons why I'm being told to do things. Not only because I'm precocious and obnoxious, but also because it helps me really, I mean, I don't like to say get better at the practice, but if I understand the reason why I'm supposed to be doing something, it helps me create it correctly in my body, right? Because yoga looks different in everybody's bodies. So it's really important to understand anatomically the goal of a certain pose or a certain cue. It's really important to understand what the teacher is trying to accomplish in the thing that they're telling you to do. Because, for instance, maybe they're trying to get you to engage your core. Maybe they're trying to get you to straighten out your spine a little more, sit up a little taller. Whatever it is, maybe they're trying to get you to protect a certain part of your body by engaging a different part of your body. And that might look a little bit different in your body than it does in the teacher's body or in the person next to you. But if you understand what the ultimate goal is of that cue or that instruction, then you can create that effect in your own body the way that works best for you. So that, I guess that's kind of the philosophy behind why I really focus on the alignment cues. Also, you know, I want to keep people safe. There's so many stories of injuries in yoga. Yes. And the types of movements that we're doing, you can very easily injure yourself. You know, there's a lot of weight bearing happening, especially again in flow. There are a lot of quick transitions. If you're not engaging the right muscles, if you're not stacking things the right way, if you don't understand, you know, the way your body is built and the way to safely move between these poses, it's very easy to throw something out of whack. And then add to that the fact that so many people, especially my clients, you know, are sitting at a desk 8 to 12 hours a day. So their bodies are out of whack extra. their backs and their legs are miserable. Their shoulders are hunched forward. There's all sorts of stuff that happens to your body when you make it sit in a chair for that long. So if you don't really understand the principles behind these movements and these funny shapes that we're making with our bodies, then you could very easily hurt yourself.
True.
And obviously that's something that we want to avoid. We're here to help, not to hurt, right?
Absolutely.
And another thing is that it helps when I'm a student, it helps me stay focused on the practice. It helps keep my mind from wandering. The more things you give me to focus on and think about related to the practice, the less opportunity my mind has to wander back to whatever happened earlier that day or whatever's going to be happening when I get off the mat. So that's another reason for it. I think type A personalities really, that really resonates with them. That constant stream of information, not only because it helps the practice make sense to them, but it really helps them stay present and focused. And we need as much help as we can get to stay present.
Definitely.
That's actually also the reason why I really like to use music when I teach. It's just another layer that your mind can hook into instead of that hamster wheel.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been a very musical person, and so I take great pride in my playlists. I really enjoy building the playlists, and when I practice, the music actually makes a big difference to me. If the music is planned according to the sequence of the class, it can really enhance the experience quite a bit. If it's an energetic practice where you're trying to really challenge yourself and maybe move quickly or challenge your strength, upbeat music can really help raise your energy levels. That certainly has always been the case for me. Versus if it's a more relaxing practice, then obviously having the right kind of music can really help create that mood as well. And music that you know and love, or even just music that sounds great and is fun to listen to, can really enhance that experience as well and help you stay present.
Do you create a separate playlist for every class, or do you have a closet of playlists that you bring out for certain classes?
I'd like to say I have the time to create a new playlist every time I teach. I probably every few weeks create it. I teach four times a week, and each class is totally different, so each class needs a totally different kind of playlist. So I save them all. They're all on Spotify. You can follow me, Alia0628, if you want to steal any of my playlists. I'm always happy to share. And so if I haven't had time to create a new playlist that week, I just dive into the archives and pull one up from before.
But there's a fair number of classes that you are creating a brand new playlist.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because it's something I love to do. And my clients appreciate it. So many people, the reason why my playlists are public is because people ask for them all the time.
And you don't use any of the quote unquote yoga music, the chanting,
I don't use anything that has religious stuff in it. So definitely nothing that involved, because almost all of the music, the yoga music out there with chanting incorporates at least some religious element to it. And obviously you have to know your Sanskrit and know your Hindu, it's mostly Hindu stuff. Know a little bit about that to be able to recognize that. And honestly, it frustrated me a lot as a student. When I first started practicing yoga, I was still a practicing Muslim. But I'm Indian, and so growing up, I knew many Hindu families as well, and I'm very familiar both with the religion and the culture on that side of the Indian world, I guess you could say. And so I probably am a lot more familiar with it than many of the Americans who have just done their 200-hour training, and that's really the only exposure they've ever gotten to Hinduism and Hindu culture, Indian culture. So, you know, I would take these yoga classes, and they would play, like, a Katy Perry song, and then the next song would have these super religious chants with the names of different gods and, you know, the sort of thing that my friends would recite when they went to temple on Sundays. And I was just like, I'm not really sure this teacher knows what they're playing. Like, I think they know this is yoga music, but either they don't understand how religious this is, or they do and they don't have respect for it, because why on earth did they just sandwich it in between these two, like, super, frankly, inappropriate pop songs? Not inappropriate for a yoga class, but inappropriate to be paired with, in my mind at least, that level of religious content.
So inappropriate in context.
Yes, exactly. Inappropriate in context. So I found context. So I found that frustrating. But then in addition to that, it just made me uncomfortable, because those aren't the gods that I worship. Those aren't the religious beliefs that I hold. And I really, while the practice was very powerful and effective for me, I didn't see any reason why it had to be linked to that one specific religion. And it made me uncomfortable to practice in classes where there were elements of a religion that I didn't believe in and didn't subscribe to that were, you know, that were part of the class.
Now, for those that are hearing this right now and might have the response, well, you know, this is the context of yoga. Yoga comes from this religion. Do you have a response for someone that might bring that up?
I mean, first of all, my understanding is that the roots of yoga do not stem solely from Hinduism, right? There are a lot of different roots. And even the philosophical portion of my teacher training was a mix of Buddhist teachings and Hindu teachings. I've been reading recently, apparently there are some African roots to the origins of yoga as well. So that's something that I want to learn more about. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. To me, yoga is about the mind-body connection. It's about learning how to turn off that hamster wheel of your mind and focus, be present, and use your body to help connect to your breath, to your mind, to your soul, to those deeper parts of your existence. And it's also about really learning to read the messages that your body is sending you and learning a set of tools to respond to those messages. I don't understand why that needs to be tied to any specific religion or religious text or mythology. And like I said before, I think that the principles underlying yoga are extremely powerful and totally universal. Compassion, self-care, kindness. The yamas and the niyamas are, for those of you who are yoga teachers or who have studied, you know, that level of the eight limbs of the yoga practice, there's nothing in there that is specific to any particular religion. These are all super universal principles that we're talking about here. You know, nonviolence and cleanliness, hygiene even is in there, right? Like, I'd hope most religions would be cool with that. So yeah, I think, sure, there are some cultural links to, obviously there are a lot of cultural links to India, and a number of them are linked to Hinduism as well. But I think as with anything, as it modernizes, as it spreads, as it finds its way into other parts of the world, it's got to grow with the times, mm-hmm. right? And so what I've created, I think, is a version of this practice that really speaks to a fairly large population that exists today. And I think that what I've created still holds true to what I believe are the core tenets of the practice and still brings that value to these people, but does it in a way that actually makes sense to them, resonates with them, and fits into their everyday lives. And that's how it becomes a sustainable practice.
So it's yoga for the agnostics.
No, it's yoga for type A people.
Okay.
Many of whom are Christian or Jewish or, you know, have their own. That's what it is everyone's got their own personal spiritual belief system. And I believe spirituality is a very personal thing. Everyone's got to find their own path, and we all need to respect each other's paths, right? I don't believe it's my place to force anything on anybody or preach anything to anybody. I believe that my system is to simply introduce people to a set of tools and let them pick up the tools that work for them. So I'm there to offer guidance. I'm there to, you know, maybe open them up to some new experiences. But it's really up to them to choose what works for them and what doesn't. And I don't think, other than, you know, keeping them safe, I don't think it's my place to say what's right or what's wrong.
So their spiritual journey is their situation, and you're not related to that.
Their spiritual journey is their choice. And I'm offering them some options that they may or may not want to pick up along the way. But it's up to them whether they want to pick them up.
So let's go back to your lawyer roots, your legal roots. How did you get from being a lawyer to being a studio owner?
Well, so my undergrad degree was in business, and I had a lot more fun in business school than I did in law school. I probably should have paid a little bit more attention to that fact than I did. And my plan had always been to become a lawyer and make some money and then do whatever I wanted after that, and that likely would involve starting some kind of business. So when I was in college, I actually ran a little cookie company out of my apartment for a little while just to try my hand at entrepreneurship. And I definitely loved running my own business, but it was very obvious to me very quickly that it's not something you want to do with zero money in your pocket. So, and I also, you know, I wanted to learn some things, really understand how the world works before I tried to branch out on my own. I thought that was important too. So, I went to law school, got a job with a good law firm, ended up staying there a little bit longer than I had initially. I thought it would be 2 years and I'd be out of there, but I ended up being there for almost 5 years. And then my father passed away very suddenly and unexpectedly. And he was my best friend in the entire world. Mm. And that was, I mean, to say it was a life-changing experience is an understatement, but it really was a wake-up call for me. And it forced me to face the fact that we don't know how much time we have on this earth. Nothing is a given. We're not in control as much as we want to be or want to think that we are. And that I did not want to waste another day of my life doing something that I wasn't absolutely passionate about. And, you know, I was fine at being a lawyer. I wasn't great at it. I knew it was not what I was meant to do. I knew it was not the thing that I was so great at that it was what I was put on this planet to do. I knew there was something out there that was a much better fit for me. And I think that was part of why the job felt so unfulfilling for me, was because I knew it wasn't the right fit for me. I knew there was something better that I could be doing for the world, something better I could be putting out into the world, a better use of my time. So I embarked on a very long and winding journey to figure out what that thing was that I wanted to do. I got a job as a food writer because I thought I wanted to open a coffee shop and bakery. Very quickly realized I did not want to do that, especially if work-life balance was a value that I wanted to have more of in my life. The restaurant industry is not the place to find that. So I moved on to real estate, did that for a couple of years, and that was a better fit, but I knew that still wasn't it. And then while I was actually searching for office space for one of my clients, I stumbled across the space where I eventually opened my yoga studio. Meanwhile, while all of that was going on, I also completed my teacher training and began teaching at what I think is the best studio in Washington, D.C. Well, one of, now that I've opened my studio.
The second best.
So I started teaching for them, and I've always been fascinated by small businesses. So anytime I walk into any kind of small business, whether it's a restaurant or a shop or a yoga studio, I think of, I look at how they're running things. I think about what I maybe would want to do differently or what I might be able to do better or what I think they could be doing better. And what are they doing well? What are they great at? What's awesome about what they've built? That's just the way my mind works. I find that really fascinating. So it had really never occurred to me to open a yoga studio. That was not something, it's not like that was, had always been my dream or anything like that. But I walked into this space and all the pieces sort of fell into place in my head. And I just knew in my gut that I needed to open a studio there.
Now, you mentioned that you were already involved in yoga teacher training. So you must have had in your mind that being a yoga teacher might be in your future.
So that's an interesting question, because I actually went into the training not because I wanted to be a teacher, but because I just wanted to learn more about the practice. I wanted to dive more deeply into it because it had already helped me so much in dealing with my grief and, dealing with other difficult things that had happened in my life. And I could tell that simply by attending yoga classes, which are really just guided practices, right? I was only barely scratching the surface of what I could tell was a really powerful practice and body of knowledge. And so I wanted to learn more. And so that was actually why I went into teacher training. But of course, part of teacher training is that you have to teach. And it turned out that I actually really enjoyed teaching. And teaching has actually always been a part of my life some way or another. I always tutored as my volunteer work when I was in school. I taught SAT classes when I was in college, all that sort of thing. So I don't know why it didn't occur to me that I would probably enjoy teaching yoga as much as I did. But yeah, as I was going through teacher training and doing my karma yoga and practicing teaching on people, I realized it was something that I really enjoyed. So I started teaching. That studio hired me to teach for them a little while after I completed my teacher training. And that was my experience with the yoga studio world until I found my space.
Okay. Now, you said that you are Indian, so that's how you knew yoga, because all Indians know yoga, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially the Muslim ones. No, not at all. When I graduated from law school, actually, it was actually after I took the bar. I really wish that it happened before I had taken the bar exam. But a very good friend of mine sent me a book by a yoga studio owner in D.C. that she had discovered while she was in law school and that she loved. And she was like, hey, we're about to start working at law firms. We're going to need a way to help manage the stress. This has really been working for me. I think you should check it out. And so I did. And I will admit there were lots of things in that book that made me roll my eyes, but there were also a lot of things in there that really resonated with me and made sense and seemed super helpful. So I got curious about it and I started taking some classes. And to be totally honest, in the beginning, the thing that kept me coming back was the physical experience. Mm-hmm. And I remember those first few classes I took did not feel very good. I especially remember they made us sit for a long time in the beginning. And I didn't know how to sit properly, so my back hurt so much. Oh my God, it was misery. But I think I bought like some sort of beginner's package or something, so I at least wanted to finish that out. And within that first week, by the end of that week, I was able to do some stuff that I couldn't do at the first class. And that was a really cool experience for me because I was never an athletic person growing up. I tried. Oh my God. I tried out for like every team there was to try out for. Never made it. Never even made the first cut. I was just like never a naturally athletic person. So to suddenly have found something that actually like seemed to work for my body where I could, you know, I was already seeing quote unquote progress was a really exciting experience for me. So that was initially what kept me coming back. And then soon after that, I started to notice that I was always in a really good mood after yoga class. And if I didn't take my yoga class, I was in a really crappy mood. And I like being in a good mood. So
sure.
So I guess we could say that was when the mental benefits started to kick in.
Okay.
Yeah. So then I started going more. And then, you know, some kind of crappy stuff happened to me. And yoga helped me work through the sadness of that, and I started reading a little more and studying a little more, and yeah, the rest is history, I guess.
Okay. All right, so you opened a yoga studio. Did you find the studio was successful quickly, or did you have some other job that you were doing while the studio was ramping up? How was that process?
I still was practicing real estate. But my intention was to really run the studio full time. I figured to do it correctly, to do it well, it was going to be a full time job, and I was right. Yeah. So was it an immediate success? I mean, I guess that depends on how you define success. Like, we had people coming in through the doors the first day we opened, and we opened in the middle of a blizzard. So that was pretty cool. You know, I was able to pay the bills and keep the lights on within the first month. Part of that was because my landlord's awesome and the rent is super low, and which was part of the reason why, one of the many reasons why I opened the studio in that space was the numbers really made a lot of sense. In terms of getting my message out and reaching the people, I feel like it really took the first year for that to kind of come together, right? In the beginning, I think we were just the new yoga studio in the neighborhood. And so anybody who was curious about yoga came to check us out. And some people liked it and stayed, and some people didn't. But then the word started getting out. People started telling friends of theirs who they thought could use some yoga, but hadn't liked their experiences before. They started telling them, like, hey, you should check this studio out, check this woman out. They do things differently. She used to be a lawyer. You know, it's not... And also, our space is very beautiful. I have a passion for design, and I wanted to create a space that felt like a retreat that made people feel like they weren't in D.C. anymore. And I am fortunate I had the means to make that happen. And so we're actually DC's only rooftop yoga studio. We have an outdoor and indoor space. We hold classes in both spaces.
When you say both spaces, you mean both the outdoor and indoor. Indoor.
Yeah. Okay. So we have classes year round. Obviously when it's too cold, we move inside. So, you know, that was unique. Also, I found that a number of yoga studios don't really put too much investment into their design. They're fairly simple spaces, and I understand why, and that's fine. But, you know, I'm trying to create a different experience. For me, I really enjoy, I think yoga is a fully sensory experience. So practicing in a beautiful surrounding with awesome music makes a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Now, you'd said that when you found the space and the landlord was offering very inexpensive rent. So you must have had some sort of idea of what the costs were going to be. Did you have a business plan?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So this is the interesting thing, right? The path from law firm to yoga studio, while I was traversing it, felt very meandering, felt like I kept hitting a lot of dead ends. I kept trying things and they didn't work out. And it was really frustrating, really difficult. It was a period of 2 years little bit over 2 years from the time I left the law firm to the time I opened the yoga studio. But keep in mind, I started this journey the year before I left the firm. So it was really a little over 3 years that I was trying to figure out what the hell I wanted to do with my life. And it's tough. Like, I talk to people a lot about the difference between being comfortable and being happy. And some people are fine with settling for their comfort zone. They're okay with, you know, I hate my job, but it allows me to have a life that I like pretty well at night and on weekends, and that's good enough for me. But there are a lot of people out there that want more, that feel this, you know, gnawing kind of dissatisfaction somewhere inside, and they want more and they don't know how to get it. And that is the difference between comfortable and happy. Comfortable just means you're familiar with it. It's easy because it's what you've always known. But that doesn't mean you're happy. It just means it's easy. Happy is you're happy. You can't wait to get up in the morning. You're excited about what the next day holds for you. You love every, maybe not every moment. I mean, it's still work. I don't like dealing with my taxes and all that kind of stuff. But for the most part, I'm nuts about everything that I get to do with my life. And that's awesome feeling, to say the least. Those are two very different states of being, comfortable and happy.
Absolutely.
But to get from comfortable to happy, there necessarily has to be a really crappy part in between, because the first step is getting out of your comfort zone. So the first step is getting uncomfortable, and that doesn't feel good, right? But if you're willing to stick it out, if you're willing to do the work, if you trust your gut and you follow it, you will find your way to happy. And I think it's totally worth it. Everybody else I know who's made that journey, once they get to happy, 1,000% it was worth it. I think that there's probably a personality type for whom that journey is worth it, and a personality type for whom it's maybe not. And so we're probably a self-selecting group. Those of us who go through that journey and are willing to put up with it, in the end, we always think that it's worth it because we're the personality type that would, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe it's a self-fulfilling prophecy in that way. But anyhow, so the point being, this whole, you know, 3+ year journey that I went on, following my gut from point to point, from food writing to real estate to teaching yoga to all the other little things. Oh yeah, there was a stint interviewing with McKinsey and BCG. That's where I started. I thought I wanted to go into consulting.
What's McKinsey and BCG?
Those are two of the biggest management consulting firms out there. And it basically is the business version of working for a big corporate law firm. So the work would probably have been more interesting to me, but the culture, the lifestyle would have been the same.
Yeah, it sounds a little bit like jumping from the frying pan into the fire.
Exactly. And that's why it was the first thing I tried, because it was the most comfortable.
Familiar.
It was the most similar. Yeah. It was the tiniest step that I could take away from my comfort zone. So I started there, but then kept moving farther and farther away. But the interesting thing was, when I found that space, when I walked into that space and I was looking around, every single thing that I had done professionally up until that point somehow played into what I was going to need in order to make that studio a reality. Mm. The food writing gig, I met lots of restaurant owners and commercial real estate brokers. I learned a lot about how small business works in Washington, D.C., about the permitting process, about negotiating commercial leases, and how commercial retail works. I also learned a lot about all of the development happening in that part of D.C. So I knew that there was a Whole Foods opening up 5 blocks away from that spot in less than 2 years. Yeah. So all of that, you know, there, and I could go on, there's a whole mess of stuff that I knew because I had done so many things over the past 2 years and change, and it all somehow lent itself to what I needed to be able to build a successful business. And you asked if I had a business plan. I absolutely had a business plan. I had to beat out 5 other businesses that wanted that space. My landlord had actually left that space empty for a year because he wanted the right tenant in there. And so he had been rejecting people all year long. And at the time when I found it, there were five, including one other yoga studio, there were five other businesses applying. And we had to write business plans and submit them. And he chose mine.
Do you know why he chose yours?
Oh, yeah. He told me that he felt like it was the most well thought out. It was the most viable. The fact that I wanted to make the renovations that I did to his space was really attractive to him as well. He could tell that I was going to take good care of the space. He could tell that I was a serious business person. and he, with his, because he actually was a small business owner as well. He's owned various auto body shops all over the city in addition to his portfolio of real estate properties. So he knows a thing or two about business, and he read that business plan and believed that it was more than viable, that it was very likely to succeed. It was a nice little vote of confidence.
Absolutely. Yeah. And beating out, especially for a business that's a new venture for you, to beat out a bunch of other people, even though you have experience in business in general, absolutely. That's something to be very proud of. Now, you also were talking, you were gushing about your work. You were very happy and how much you enjoy what it is that you do. And the last few interviews that I've done, the conversation has taken a very similar turn, that even though sometimes we don't make as much money as we could have in a corporate life, it doesn't matter because there's so much joy in our experience. It's nice to hear your enthusiasm. I'm sure there were times you had to clean toilets or do your bookkeeping, which is never fun, but as you say, the majority of your job is joyful.
Yes, the majority of my job is joyful. Now, here's one of the things that I think does set me apart from a lot of the other yoga teachers and yoga studio owners out there. I am not afraid of making money, and in fact, I am incredibly ambitious, and one of my goals when I left the law firm was to get myself back to that place financially, but find a way to do it, all getting paid to do stuff that I love. Mm. And I'm pretty close.
All right. How many hours a week would you say you work? Or per day, or how do you frame that?
You know, that's such a hard question to answer because I'm always thinking about my business. I'm always talking about my business. And most of what I do related to my business, I don't think of it as work. You know what I mean? But I mean, there is work. Like, I have to respond to clients. I have to deal with taxes and permits and boring things. And there certainly are things that would traditionally be defined as work that I have to do on a regular basis. But I mean, one of my favorite things about my life now is that I don't have to set an alarm in the morning. And I'm not a morning person. You came to my 8 a.m. class this morning. You know, that was struggles McGee for me. I don't have to set an alarm in the morning. I never schedule, if I can avoid it, I never schedule anything for myself before noon. That way my mind knows that there's no chance I'm going to oversleep for anything I have to do, and I can wake up naturally. Like, my body can just get as much sleep as it wants to. That's pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you never clock out.
No, I won't say that. I do think that even though I love what I do, it is really important to unplug from it and to take a break from whatever your day-to-day is. Because it is still work, and it does take energy, and it does drain. So for me, on a weekly basis, from the time the studio closes Saturday, like noon-ish, noon 30, until we reopen Sunday morning, that's my weekend.
Okay.
I try to unplug digitally as much as possible, try to go screen free if I can. I don't check my emails, don't do anything related to the studio if possible. I just go out or, you know, do something with friends or whatever it is. But the rest of the week, I get home from the studio. If I stay until close, which I do most nights, I get home at 9 o'clock at night. Which is, you know, a little bit later than most jobs, though honestly not really any later than I would get home from the law firm.
Really?
And I started a lot earlier there. Yeah. I mean, there were times at the firm where I would work till 6 a.m., go home, take a shower, and have to come back. Like, that was a really brutal life. I don't work those kinds of hours anymore. I don't have to. I can, you know, in the very beginning, I do think I was working probably like 70 to 80 hours a week. There's a lot of stuff to do to get a new business up off the ground.
Sure.
But now I'd say it's probably closer to 40 or 50.
Okay. Yeah. Do you have any rituals, business-related rituals, daily, weekly, annually?
Business-related, I set every Monday morning, I create a new to-do list for the week. I look at last week's list and pull over any items that didn't get checked off, and then I add to it whatever else needs to get taken care of that week. That's probably my biggest, like, productivity ritual. But I start every day with coffee and a walk and meditation.
Okay.
So I've got kind of a half hour ritual that I start each day with that I've found the walk piece of it especially really helps my energy level the rest of the day. So I'm not somebody who can do my full workout in the morning. I'm creaky when I wake up. It doesn't feel good if I try to do... like, go all out the way I like to when I work out, first thing when I wake up. It doesn't feel good during the workout. I don't feel great after the workout. Nothing about it is a good situation. But I've found that if I move, if I just walk, and I got one of these little step counter things, it makes such a big difference. It not only does it help wake me up first thing in the morning, but my energy is so much more sustained throughout the day, which mm-hmm. is awesome. So I live in a big apartment building with I'm very fortunate, huge, beautiful rooftop deck. So I just take my coffee upstairs and do laps around the roof in the morning and to wake up, and then do a little bit of yoga once I feel my body warmed up. Just kind of stretch out and then sit. They've got these really lovely rocking chairs that look out over the Capitol building, and sit there and set a timer for 5 or 10 minutes, depending on how much time I have, and meditate. And it makes such a difference to the rest of my day.
Now, my next question, you sort of answered that with that one right there. But again, rituals could be daily, weekly, annually. Do you have any that are sort of a personal? And of course, that one sounds like right. It's both personal and business. Do you have any others that could be either personal or business?
So other business ones, I try to do at least a quarterly check-in, like a goal setting and a brain dump. Mm-hmm. So, I do in it again, I pull the last one I did and look at what worked and what didn't, what I was able to get done and what I wasn't, and then set, make a list of all the ideas that I have for the coming months. I always have tons of ideas. They're not all viable. There isn't enough time to try all of them out. So I got to prioritize them and be realistic about them. And it's really, really important to constantly look back and assess. I think that I believe in failing fast and moving forward. But I think you've got to learn lessons from every failure.
Mm-hmm.
So I try a lot of things. This is one of my favorite things about being my own boss. I can try whatever I want, whenever I want. My successes are mine to take credit for, but my failures are mine to own as well. And it's nice to not be beholden to anybody else. Like, if I fail at something, there isn't anyone else relying on me, right? So I can just take responsibility for that failure and move forward. And in business, you can't take it personally. You can't get emotionally attached to your ideas. If something's not working, it's not working. You look at the numbers, they tell you whether it's working or not, and you move forward.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So yeah, that like regular sort of brain dump and assessment, and then, okay, what's the next sort of set of goals and ideas, and then prioritizing them and what's realistic, what makes sense to start with.
Sure.
So yeah, I'd say that's another one of my rituals. Personal rituals. I know I have more, and I'm just blanking on them right now because I really do. Oh, that's right. My pre-bedtime ritual. I definitely believe that going screen-free at least 30 minutes before bedtime really, really helps me sleep better.
Okay.
And I've recently jumped on the adult coloring book bandwagon. And oh my God, I am all about it. I used to sketch and draw and charcoal when I was a kid, and I've always had a really artistic side. And I think the coloring book thing is a really easy way to tap into that side, and it's super fun. I'm such a nerd. I have like mason jars with my colored pencils, and they're like organized my color group, and it's all set out beautifully on my coffee table. It looks like my apartment looks like a Pinterest board, just because that's fun for me. So before bed, okay, we're gonna get real honest here. I'm also a huge Harry Potter fan. And I've read and reread, like I probably have all the books memorized at this point, but I never get tired of them. And the audiobooks are awesome.
Brilliant.
The guy who reads them, Jim Dale, is some, I guess, pretty famous British actor. He like does all the voices. Oh my God. It's amazing. Wow. So I throw on some Harry Potter and I pull out my coloring book. And I just unwind because there's something about getting into someone else's story that helps you kind of shut yours off before bed, sure. You know? And the fact that it's a story that I already know really well, I don't really have to pay that much attention to it versus if it were a book I were listening to for the first time, I wouldn't want to fall asleep during it, right? But the guy's voice is soothing and I know the story and it's okay if I kind of zone out a little bit. So I pull out my coloring book and my pencils and I throw on Harry Potter and I just unwind.
Well, you heard it here first, folks. Coloring books and Harry Potter.
Secret to happiness right there.
All right, so we're going to switch directions just for the last few minutes of this. And we're going to talk directly to people that might be looking towards yoga as a career or looking to develop their career further within yoga. You'd mentioned that you were asked to come to Wanderlust to teach. Is there anything that you were aware of that you did to make that happen?
That is a fantastic question. So last December, I actually launched a retail line. It's a line of self-care products. It's candles, bath salts, sugar scrubs, moisturizing sprays. They're all handmade locally. I work with this fantastic woman who lives half an hour outside of DC. And I designed all the products, the fragrance blends, the packaging, the labeling. And she just makes it all and brings it all to the studio for me.
Okay.
So local, handmade, artisan, beautiful products, natural ingredients, good for you stuff. And when I launched it, it caught the attention of a magazine in DC called The Washingtonian, which is kind of a big deal magazine. And so they did a little profile on me. They were really interested in my whole story, the, you know, lawyer to yoga studio to retail line, whatever. So they did a profile and somebody at Wanderlust saw it and shot me an email and said, "Hey, do you want to come teach? We're doing one of these over in West Virginia. It's not too far away from you. We'd love for you to come." Huh. And I was like, absolutely, this sounds super cool. I've never done anything like this before. So I said yes, and here I am.
Had you ever attended a yoga festival before?
No, and I will be totally honest. This is not the sort of thing that I probably would ever have done on my own. Certainly not before I became a teacher. There are some things going on here that are a little eye roll inducing for my ilk. I will admit that. But again, to each their own, totally respect that everyone's, you know, doing their thing. And I love that.
Are you talking about the sound healing booth down there?
I'm not going to name any names. Not on the record, at least. But I will tell you, there was a big eye roll when they told me there was a body art painting something gal who was going to be stationed outside one of my classes. Mm-hmm. Like, you know what? Okay. Grown-up face painting. Why not? That sounds like fun.
Especially coming from someone that likes coloring books.
This is fair. Absolutely fair. I mean, I'll be honest, I was a little bit surprised that they were interested in me, because my shtick, right, is that I'm the anti-hippy-dippy yoga teacher.
Yeah.
It says it on the homepage of my studio. We skip the hippy-dippy stuff. It's like the first line on the page. So I was pleasantly surprised that they were interested in me. And then I put all my classes together, the 90s playlist and all that stuff. And all the 90s classes filled up, like, right away. They actually had to move one of them to a bigger venue so they could fit on all the people off the wait list, which was super exciting for someone who's never done anything like this before. And really made me think that, you know, I think there's really a market for what I'm trying to do here. There's more than a market, I think there's a need for it. There's a desire for it out there. And I was really pleasantly surprised by the time we got here. I taught a basics workshop this morning. Today was the first day of the workshop, and it was sold out. It was totally full. And, you know, the fact that there were a bunch of people who came all the way out here to this festival who were newer to yoga, and my story resonated with them, and they liked the idea of learning from somebody with my kind of approach to teaching,
mm-hmm.
was really cool. And I got to tell you, teaching that was so much fun this morning. I love working with beginners. I love introducing people to yoga and really diving deep into all the details around, like, those fundamental poses that really make up our sequences in the vinyasa practice, and really watching, you know, the light bulbs go off in people's heads when I explain to them how to open up their shoulders in down dog, or explain to them why I teach chaturanga the way I do, or, you know, there's so many details that really go into this practice and my teaching. And it's really cool to share that with people who appreciate it.
And it's worth mentioning for the people that are listening that when someone researches or looks into what classes they want to take when they're at a festival like this, the first thing you come across, if you're looking down the schedule, is the name and then the brief description of the class. And so all of your classes seem to reference a specific music style, the music that's going to be played during the class. And then you go and you read the description and you get a little more detail. And then if one were to go and learn a little bit about more you to say, okay, this sounds interesting. Do I want to listen to this person for an hour and a half?
Right.
Then you maybe learn a little bit more about the style in which you're going to present the information. And so it's really important to have not just a catchy name. It doesn't have to be clever, punny. In this case, it's the music.
Yeah.
And then the description, and then who you are. I don't want to say that's least important, but that's one of the last things, unless someone is really seeking you out as a person. Where can I find Alia and the class that she's teaching?
Well, so here's what's cool, is after that first class this morning, a handful of people came up to me and they were like, we looked up your schedule, we're coming to the rest of your classes this weekend.
Perfect.
That felt awesome.
Sure.
Not gonna lie. That's really exciting to know that there are people out there who are excited about what I'm doing and, you know, want to be a part of it.
And that's one of the interesting challenges to being a yoga teacher, is that we do it for ourselves. We do it also to make a living. But when people resonate with what we're doing, yeah, it's a little bit affirming. It is a little exciting to know they appreciate what I appreciate.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So for people that, you may not be able to answer this first one. People that are looking that might want to get into the festival teaching circuit, do you have any advice or suggestions for them?
Be really good at what you do.
Good advice.
Well, okay, so my roommate here she teaches hula hooping, and they found her through her YouTube channel. She has a YouTube channel where she posts hula hooping tutorials. So they were able to see that she is good at what she does.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they found her.
And for people that are listening again, at these festivals, they put up the teachers in some of the rooms. And so the teachers will often be paired with another teacher. And so your roommate is someone that you've never met before,
right,
but who's also a presenter here at the festival.
Yep. You're right. And it's a 2-bedroom situation, so it's nothing weird.
And awfully nice.
It is, yeah. No, they did not skimp out on this piece of it, which is pretty exciting. I don't know. Honestly, I wish I had a better answer. I can tell you how they found me. I know how they found her.
Okay.
There are a few, like, really high profile, famous, internationally known yoga teachers here, so I'm pretty sure I know how they found them. But as for the rest, my guess is really, you know, find your niche and hone your craft and get the word out about who you are, whether you're doing that through social media or through press coverage or, you know, however you can. And it seems like Wanderlust is always looking for new talent and great talent out there. So if you're putting yourself out there, they'll probably find you.
When I interviewed Ariane Traverso in the last episode, she talked a lot about finding your niche and how important that is to set yourself apart from other teachers.
Absolutely, yeah.
Whether it's a different style or a different way of presenting a common style, whatever it might be. Do you have any tips for teachers with respect, or not teachers, but people that might want to get into studio ownership?
Well, don't do it if the only reason you want to do it is because you love to teach. Because owning a studio and teaching yoga are two very different career paths. I love teaching yoga. I would say it's about 7% of what I do right now. So really make sure that you understand everything that goes into owning and running a studio before you make that commitment, both financially and, I mean, emotionally, energetically. It will, I think, if you're doing it right, it'll consume your life.
If you're doing it right.
Yeah. Not that I'm opinionated or anything. But also, you know, I think this goes back to what I was saying before about making money. And I realize I may have come off a little bit arrogant, but the truth is, if you want to be a business owner, you can't be afraid of making money. And one of the things that really frustrates me most about the yoga teaching world is how often yoga teachers devalue themselves. Mm. They work for free. They let themselves get paid pennies. You know, this is not easy work. And this is important work. We go through a lot of training. And then on top of that, you know, we have a lot of teaching experience. We have a lot of knowledge to impart. And we're really changing people's lives if we're, you know, when we're dedicated to what we do.
Sure.
I have people who came to me because they couldn't sleep through the night because of their hip pain. And within 3 months, they were sleeping through the night. You know, these are real changes that we are affecting on people. And that's valuable.
And let me just follow up on that. When someone is in physical pain all day and all night long, this is not just a mild discomfort. This affects your mood. This affects the people around you.
Exactly.
This is big stuff.
Yeah, this is absolutely big stuff. It's valuable stuff, and it deserves to be valued, and there's nothing wrong with getting paid for what you do.
Very true. Yeah. Do you have any tips for people that are involved in the yoga business in whatever way with respect to life balance? I feel like this is a real challenge for some teachers.
Yeah, absolutely. So for teachers, I think one of the first things that goes when you first become a yoga teacher is your own personal practice. And I think it's so important to make sure you are carving out time for a regular practice once you start teaching. Mm. Not only because self-care is still just as important when you're a yoga teacher as it was before you became a yoga teacher, but also because when you start taking classes as a teacher, your experience changes a little bit. And honestly, every single yoga class I take, I learn something new. Either I take something away from it that I want to add to my teaching, or I learn something new that I want to make sure that I don't do when I teach.
Sure.
But that's an important part of your growth as a teacher. But of course, just to maintain your sanity and your balance in life, if you value the yoga practice enough to become a teacher, then you need to value it enough to keep it in your life.
Sure. Great point. Advice for teachers or studio owners with respect to marketing? And just pick one or two.
You need a brand. You need a clear message. We already talked a little bit about finding your niche. You absolutely need to figure out what differentiates you from your competition. So otherwise, why are people going to come to you? You might know that you're special and you're a unicorn sitting on top of a fairy in a four-leaf clover and a four whatever it is. Like, you know what makes you awesome, but nobody else does until you tell them. Hmm. And I guess this is another thing that comes up in the yoga world and that people think might run counter to yoga culture. People have a hard time talking about themselves and talking themselves up.
Yeah.
But, I mean, again, it's just, first of all, it's just business 101. You got to tell people that you're out there, and you got to tell people why they want to come to you. It's not bragging. It's just, it's how you run a business. And of course, you want to keep a little bit of humility no matter what. You certainly, you know, there's a line between arrogance and marketing. And that's important to keep in mind. But but you can't be afraid to promote yourself. And you need to have a very clear message and brand around what you're promoting. And if you don't know how to create that, get someone to help you do it. It will be worth the investment. There's no question. And it's, I know, when you're a new business owner, spending money is so scary. Spending money on stuff that you think you're supposed to be able to DIY. And look, I DIY'd almost every single thing when I opened my business. I still do most of it. I designed the website. I designed my logo. I did all of the marketing. I did all of the legal work. I did all the, I negotiated the lease. But I have a real estate license. I have a law degree. I have a marketing degree. Like, I have those skill sets. You know what I don't have? An accounting degree. You know what the first thing was I did when I opened my business? Hire a bookkeeper. Hire a payroll system. Find a CPA. Yeah. Know your strengths. Know your weaknesses. Get help where you need it. DIY what you can. And pay for what you can't. It's worth it.
Great advice. Do you have any particular ways that you like to give back in any way?
Oh, yeah. And I do think, you know, as much as I talk about how important it is to make money and value yourself, one of the things I most admire about the yoga philosophy and the yoga practice is the emphasis on what they like to call karma yoga, on service, on giving back. I think that's just such an important part of being a human citizen of this world. So actually next weekend, I'm in the process of organizing a huge fundraiser barbecue for this fantastic refugee organization called IRAP. It's the International Refugee Assistance Project. And they basically assist incoming refugees with any legal issues that they need help with. So I'm working with a neighborhood barbecue group and one of the neighborhood resistance organizations, and we assembled a whole bunch of really awesome, like, home chefs and pit masters and whatnot, and we're throwing a big party and selling tickets and raising money, and really excited about that.
Yeah.
I'm working with a local dog rescue. I want to do some pet adoption events at the studio because we've got a great outdoor space for that. So we're looking at hosting a couple of those in the fall. But the cause that is, it's nearest and dearest to my heart, but has also been the most difficult to work with, but I'm not giving up on it, is that I really, really want to help make yoga and meditation a more regular part of the curriculum in our public schools, or in all of our schools, really. I think that these are concepts, practices that people need to be taught at a young age, both the haves and the have-nots. Mm-hmm. Because a big part of what this practice teaches is compassion. A big part of what it teaches is how to manage difficult emotions. These are important. Not only are they important skills to help you manage your own life, but I genuinely believe that if we were all better at these things, the world would be a better place. And you got to start. What did Whitney say? The children are our future, right? We got to start them young.
She did say that.
Yes, she did. So I've been trying to work with some of the public schools. Our neighborhood is what you might call transitioning. So I've been trying to work with some of the public schools around on that. And, you know, it's not the fastest moving project, but we're making roads.
Okay.
And, I believe in that. I think it's an important cause, and I'm going to keep chipping away at it. Okay.
Do you consider yourself an introvert or an extrovert?
What do you think? I'm absolutely an extrovert.
I would have thought.
Yeah. I love being around people. I love interacting with people. I definitely feed off of people. My energy level expands exponentially when I'm interacting with people. But that said, I need my me time. I need recovery time. And when I was younger, I didn't understand that about myself. I was scared to be alone. I think a lot of people are afraid to be alone. I don't think we're really taught how to be alone or how to be comfortable with being alone. This goes off into a whole other tangent about the culture around single people. You know, I'm a 34-year-old single woman who owns her own business. Most of the women business owners I know are married. I don't know very many. I can't think of any. Well, I can think of one off the top of my head. But she has a business partner. So that's also different. But yeah, I mean, I think learning how to be not just comfortable with being alone, but like genuinely enjoying your own company is so important. Whether you're introverted or extroverted, I think we often put way too much of a burden on our partners and our friends and our family and the people in our lives. We make them responsible for our happiness.
Yeah.
Nobody can do that for you, for yourself, except for you. So yeah, while I'm definitely an extrovert, I also really value alone time.
One last question. Your journey is a little bit atypical. It doesn't really matter which category we put you into. It's fairly atypical. Mm. How was your family supportive of your?
The family that matters to me was. Before my father passed away, we always talked about how the plan was for me to become a lawyer and make some money and then leave and start my own business. He never got to see me do this part of it, but I know that it was what he wanted. And then when I actually got to the point where I was doing this, I know I'm really close to my cousins. They're all doctors. And I'm very close to my uncles, my father's brothers, all doctors or engineers, except for one. He was an engineer, and he and his wife started a very successful daycare business. So he, right off the bat, when I told him I was opening a yoga studio, he was like, fantastic, that's so smart, such a great business model, such low overhead, if the rent, like, he got it right away. That was cool. I know, nobody admitted it to me until now, but I know that the rest of them did not understand what the hell I was doing. But they trusted me because I had been so successful at all the other things I'd done before.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew that I was smart. And I've always just kind of been the black sheep of the family, I guess. Going to law school instead of med school. Whoa.
Bucking the trends.
Yeah. So they supported me for sure. And now that I'm, like, comfortable and successful and everyone feels comfortable with what I do, now they're starting to admit, yeah, I had no clue. I couldn't believe that you were doing it, that you, even when you left your law firm, I thought you were crazy. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I loved you. I believed in you. Okay. So, here you are. Cool.
Awesome. So if people want to learn more about you, get in touch with you, what is the easiest, best way, or all of the different ways that they can do that?
So many different ways, thanks to the interwebs. Probably the easiest thing to do is go to my website. It's aliajkhan.com, aliajkhan.com. The H comes before the A because I am Indian, not German. And then from my website, you can find links to my various social media platforms, the yoga studio. Of course, the studio is Eastside Yoga DC. That's the website and all of the social media handles. And then my social media handle is Alia J. Khan, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Try to keep it simple for guys.
And I'm guessing that your yoga studio is on the eastern side of Washington, D.C. Would that be?
You know, this is why they pay you the big bucks. Yes, we are located in Northeast D.C. For those of you familiar with D.C., we're technically in Capitol Hill, but we're really close to the H Street neighborhood. So kind of straddling the border between the two.
Right. Alia, is there anything else that you'd like to pass on to the people listening?
Come visit. Right. I'd love to play. No, but this has been super fun. Thank you so much for having me.
For me as well. Thank you for taking the time to talk to me. And I'm sorry we went so late.
That is okay. It's totally worth it.
Right.
As Alia puts it, she teaches real yoga for real people and is on a mission to bring yoga to people who think that it's not for them. If you enjoyed hearing Alia's story, there's lots of ways that you can connect with her. First and foremost, she runs a yoga studio in Washington, D.C. called Eastside Yoga. Her various social media are listed on the show notes at the website, yogamat.chat. including her Spotify account so that you can listen to the playlists that she used during her classes. She's also recently started a blog, which you can find the link on the show notes, and she is also running an alignment-focused 200-hour yoga teacher training this fall at her studio, so be sure to reach out to her if that's of interest to you. On the show notes, you'll also find links to some of the media that she mentioned, such as the audiobooks of Harry Potter, and also the book Hip Tranquil Chick, A Guide to Life on and Off the Yoga Mat by Kimberly Wilson. Thank you for joining us on Chats for the Mat, Yoga-Inspired Conversations with Brian McRae Davis, and a thank you to Zoe for providing the introduction. You can find a link to her social media on the show notes as well. And a big thank you to the band 13 Hands for letting us use their song Big Love on the opening and closing of this podcast. You can learn more about 13 Hands by going to their website, which is the number 13, the word hands.bandcamp.com.